Our founders, Ken and Mary, take us on a journey through the 12 steps, part 3, in progress.
So I'm going to be talking about step 6 and 7. I'll do them one at a time. But first want to read from the Code of Blue Book. Step 6 asks us to begin taking positive action towards changing those defects of character we outlined in our 4th step. It is a part of our cleansing process. Now we must apply the faith and trust we developed while working on our 2nd and 3rd steps and put them into greater action. In doing so, we take the decision of turning our will and our lives over to the care of God and advance one step further by becoming willing and ready for God to remove all of our defects of character. For some of us, considering our readiness and willingness causes us to become fearful because we don't know how to behave in healthy ways. Some of us become resistant to change or fearful of losing our power. In one way or another, our character defects emerge to provide us a sense of power, false as it is. To make the transition from self-powered, powerless individuals to healthier human beings requires the help of our higher power. Only our higher power can remove our defects of character that have provided us unhealthy defenses, protection, and false power. At times, we may be barely willing to let go. Yet even the smallest amount of willingness opens the door to the power of God's healing. Readiness and willingness are key attitudes. So just to share a little bit about that, I remember the first time, you know, of looking at the step with my codependents. And probably the best way I could describe my response to it was a little bit more of a reaction, and that was, yikes, that I'm going to be entirely ready entirely ready to have God remove these defects of character. Much is what I, you know, was talking about in the 3rd step as well, is an ongoing process with that. I think if, for, this is just what I make up for all of us, so I'll speak for all of us, but, at least for myself, I think if I would have had all those coping mechanisms, as unhealthy as they were, stripped away all at one time, I think it would have been overwhelming and probably would have created its own backlash of destruction that was there. They needed to be taken a little bit at a time, and I believe my higher power knew with each step of the way, you know, when it was time for me to address that one, to let that one go. When I was strong enough, had ego strength, had strong enough in my recovery, had done enough of my trauma work in that area, that then it was time to entirely remove that, you know, because the one thing that I knew for myself is that any of those things that I had, and I, when I look at defects of character for me, those are all our survival skills. It's what we grabbed onto in order to have that illusion of safety. So, which is, you know, all of our patterns and characteristics, the way that those showed up in our lives, and then how we, in our 4th step, wrote about those. They were just ways that we all tried to survive, in my opinion. You know, so for me, there's no shame in the fact that I was molded into having that way of thinking and behaving, but there is accountability for me to deal with those things. I have an accountability to myself. And so you know, the beginning of this step to me is also where a lot of my self-parenting of my inner child came into play. Because I needed to have a self-parent who was going to deal with that kid or that teenager inside of me that went, yikes. I needed to have a loving self-parent that was going to take my hand and basically walk me through these, being able to ready myself and be willing to let go of my defects of character, of my codependence, and the ways that that showed up. So there was a part of for me, just in this statement alone, we're entirely ready. You know, there was a lot in that for me. My inner child would show up more as kind of the scared little girl. She was the one who really wanted to hide under the bed or hide in the closet. And so the idea that some of those survival behaviors that I had were going to be taken away, that part of me was terrified. You know, that teenager wanted to, you know, just, well, then let's go get compulsive about something. Let's go fix it that way, you know. And so there was a lot just in that statement. You know, I don't think it's something that is lightly done. And so I did a lot of journaling on it for myself. It's like, what does that mean to me? You know, what would it look like for me, you know, to have God remove those defects of character? Well, you know, what does that look like? You know, I had no clue. I was just beginning to learn who I was, let alone who was I going to be without these things. That ability to truly picture that was not there. Now, some of what happened with me with this, you know, with this step is I would go into expectation about what it was supposed to look like. So things were supposed to be easy. I was supposed to be able to stand up for myself with these, have good boundaries, all of that kind of thing. But because expectations, what I came to learn for myself is that they're based in fear and they are a powerful fantasy. I would set myself up over and over and over again. So I had to, again, get back to that place of my loving self-parent. It's like, how do I need to parent myself through being willing, being ready, you know, to let God remove these defects of character? So it was my safety net, in a sense, you know, and I had to let little pieces of that safety net, you know, begin to be willing to go through that a little at a time. So part of what I'm saying with this is I didn't do this step all in one shot. You know, this was an ongoing step for me, because there was no way to just be entirely ready on every single piece that I was needing to let go of. And so I worked this one over and over. My 6 and 7 steps were, you know, ones that I just held close to me and focused on over and over and over again throughout my recovery. And there's, you know, today when something comes up, you know, so it you know, I've shared in meetings before, but it probably took me a good, you know, because of the trauma that I went through, sexual abuse a lot of times takes a bit longer to work on in some ways, and because it just permeated so many areas of my life. And so it took me a while to really get to where I was beginning to feel super comfortable in my skin. And that was probably around, you know, anywhere from 5 to 7 years into recovery, to where I could really feel that within myself. You know, this is an ongoing process. And I think, you know, personally, I believe anybody who starts this journey is just courageous, beyond words, because it's us turning ourselves inside out and allowing all those parts to be seen and, you know, dealt with and felt and examined and prayed about and, you know, surrendered to God, all of that, and then kind of beginning to put ourselves back together in that way. And I think our higher power is who puts us back together. You know, our job, at least my job, was to practice the tools, practice doing the things that I needed to do in my recovery every step of the way as something showed up. And so I'm going to move on to step seven. After I'm done with step seven, then we'll open up for some questions on both steps. So step seven. Step seven helps us to complete our spiritual cleansing process in our relationships with others. It opens our hearts even more deeply to a relationship with God. Heartfelt humility is a vital part of this step. Without it, there is little room for a higher power to work within us and through us. Step seven helps us to acknowledge our imperfections. Each of us is different. But humility allows us to experience true spiritual equality with others. In one way or another, we reach our unique bottom in our codependence. We feel a deep level of powerlessness. We learn that God can help us if we are willing to do our part in helping ourselves. Each aspect of our step work has brought us an ever-deepening understanding and experience of our humanness. Our heartfelt humility fuels our desire, readiness, and willingness to have God remove our defects of character. We ask for God's help as we apply healthy new boundaries in our relationships with God, ourselves, and others. So part of what, you know, when I was talking about, you know, developing a very strong inner self parent, for me, that part of me is what is able to trust that if I'm going to be in prayer, ask God to remove my shortcomings, come from a heart space, come from a place to where, okay, I'm now willing and teachable to start practicing new behaviors, you know, and so the seventh step for me in that, you know, that prayer for me to ask God to remove my shortcomings is saying that, okay, so if I'm going to trust that those shortcomings are going to be taken away, then I need to trust that if I do some new healthy behaviors, that God, that you got my back, that, you know, whatever, however it comes out is going to be for the highest good for myself and the other person. And so I, for myself, I didn't know how to behave in healthy ways. I didn't know how to, you know, communicate my feelings. I didn't know how to have boundaries. I didn't know how to talk to myself and treat myself in loving ways. I didn't know how to help that little girl who was being abused by her dad feel self-soothed and, you know, self-esteemed, and to be able to help her to feel that sense of closeness and care that I was there for her. I didn't know how to do that for my teenager who wanted to act out. She was the one who wanted to, you know, who drank and used and did all the many other things that I did. You know, how do I parent that part of me? I didn't know those healthy behaviors. You know, I also, you know, recognized when I got to here, I also didn't know those healthy behaviors of my own children. You know, so there was a lot of learning in this step. And so a friend of ours had a suggestion that I really like, and his name is Jimmy, and he's in a actually in another 12-step program, but how he had shared with us how he works with this, and I really like it. Because I think we need to have something to replace our shortcomings with. If I'm saying, okay, I'm going to, you know, please remove my shortcomings, I have to have something to replace it. Otherwise, I'm just going to be sitting there going, okay, what do I do next? And I came from a lot of neglect, so I didn't even know how to ask those questions on what do I do next. I would just sit there in my neglect and wait until situations came up that I didn't know how to take care of, and then feel more shame about it because I didn't know how to take care of them. So I had to get active in this step. So part of every single shortcoming that came out of the character defects from the fourth step, which were my survival behaviors, every single one of them, I had to come up with a new healthy behavior for. So I had something to replace it with. So if I was going to let go of, you know, being a runner in my life when it came to my emotions, I had to know how to show up for myself with my emotions. And so I had to start learning some tools. Now, CODA has lots of pamphlets that are just, you know, chucked full of tools and wonderful tools that, you know, members of CODA have helped put together, and our literature committee brought those together. So there's lots and lots of tools that are out there just within the CODA literature. But what I did, so back to what my friend would do, is he would take like a 3x5 card, and on one side of the card he would write down, you know, the shortcoming. And then on the other side of the card was, you know, maybe an affirmation that was connected with that, or a new behavior, a tool to use in connection with that. And do that for every single one of them. So, you know, for me, I have a stack like this that were there, the things that I was wanting to learn about myself and change in myself. And then you have two jars. So you put them all in one jar. The other jar is empty. And then you take one out each day, and that's the one you focus on for that day. Again, if I took that whole jar and, you know, dumped them on me and then said, okay, I need to do every single one of these every day, probably would have overwhelmed me, probably would have given up, thought it didn't work at all. Why try? All the messages that I would go into. And so, taking one at a time, and it's like, okay, I'm going to focus on this one today for 24 hours. I'm going to focus on being able to do communication from a place of my feelings are in I statements, and when I'm describing what was said or done. So over and over again throughout that day, I would say, like, say if it was Ken, you know, Ken, when you said this, I felt sad, or I felt angry, or I felt afraid, or I felt happy, or I felt whatever it was. Or if I'm at work, you know, a little bit, you know, picking and choosing who I might do this with at work, but going up to somebody and sharing, you know, when you shared this piece with me, I felt, and so practicing that for 24 hours with my kids, sharing with my kids. So when you didn't listen to me to turn the TV off, you know, I felt, you know, frustrated with that. You know, what I need is for you to listen to me, you know. So going through and practicing for 24 hours, just, you know, over and over and over practicing. And then at the end of that day, I put it in the empty jar. Then I pull another one out the next day. And then once I empty out the full jar into the empty jar, I start over again. And doing that over and over and over again until, you know, there's that head-to-heart connection. It becomes something that isn't so challenging for me to do, that ability to be able to know how to do healthy behaviors is stronger, you know, that I am able to then keep surrendering to God over and over and over again. Once I had some experiences of surrendering my shortcomings and trusting those outcomes to God over and over again and not having the expectations of how it's supposed to look. And I had empowered experiences with them more and more and more. I began to trust more. I began to trust that, yeah, this is okay for me to surrender this to my higher power, that everything is going to be okay. Now, some situations I may not like. They may have been a little uncomfortable how they turned out, but it was for the highest good of everybody. To me, working the sixth and seventh step is like taking our third step and putting it on steroids. You know, it's like, you know, okay, this is, you know, I'm either going to do this or I'm not. You know, I'm either going to keep playing God or I'm not. Or I'm either going to keep making you God or I'm not. What am I going to do with this? And it made a huge difference. When I saw it in that way, I knew I didn't have to have perfection in it. I knew that it was progress, not perfection. That it was, I was in ongoing evolution. And what I saw with that is that as I was practicing those things and I was practicing my self-parenting, I was then, which I believe my self-parent is who implements my boundaries. For me, my boundaries are just very, very simply what is okay and not okay for me to experience. If something's okay, I can communicate that. If something's not okay, I can be assertive and communicate that in a loving, healthy way. I like the idea of having for myself an empowered, compassionate communication. I think that's important for myself and to be able to practice that on a regular basis. And that is my self-parent in action. You know, that is the one thing that came so strongly out of working my sixth and seventh step and continuing to work that, was that my self-parent got stronger and stronger and stronger. The more that part of me strengthened, because I wasn't running on so much fear, and fear was not my God, and you were not my God, I was able to let my higher power be my higher power. And have that relationship. That relationship has to be first and foremost in my life, no matter what. And so I was able to then strengthen that relationship, that beautiful, magnificent, sacred connection that I have with my higher power. And for me, every single day, I know where my recovery's at based on where I'm at with my higher power, because that starts first. If I'm not connected there, I'm going to start going outside of myself, you know, and then I'm going to start having consequences as a result, and back to step 1 through 5, you know, all over again. So, I think what I'd like to do, I'm not sure where we are with time, but I think we're at a good time to maybe open up for questions. We still have about 25 minutes. Oh, okay. Okay. So we'll just open up for questions and that'll get plenty of time for it.
Just a heads up, we've had some members here with their hands up for quite a while, so they might be asking questions about earlier steps other than 6 and 7.
Okay.
The next one in the queue is Karen with a K. If you could unmute yourself and ask your question.
Hi. Yes, I'm Karen. Can you hear me?
Hi. Yes.
Hi. This is actually a step 2 question about something that Ken had mentioned, but I would love to hear what you have to say about it. He mentioned that making a list of ideal qualities in a higher power. What do I really want and deeply need out of a higher power? And I can kind of feel in my heart that this is going to be true, that this is going to lead me to what my higher power really is, or how my higher power really is. but I'm just wondering, like, logically, I can't wrap my brain around that. How is it that what I deeply want is just going to be reality?
So
do you see what I mean?
Yeah, absolutely. Okay. And so, you know, part of it is also taking out the old reality of maybe some transference that has been there in the past from authority figures to your higher power. And so part of what I did is I prayed for God to reveal, for that to be revealed, who God was to me, to my heart. I think we all have a personal connection, so it might show up a little differently for each person. That's separate from religions or philosophies that people might follow. You know, this is just more about how does God reveal God to me in my heart, and then trusting in that because that's all I have. So, you know, now I think, you know, it's important, you know, I remember hearing the term Santa Claus God. So I think it's important to be aware of, you know, okay, am I going off into a, you know, a fantasy that, you know, I have my magic wand and everything's going to happen kind of thing. And so being aware of that as well. But my belief is that if God reveals to me that God is a loving, wonderful, sacred, beautiful presence in my life, then that's also where my attention goes. And so that's what I see. If I see God as scary or he's, you know, God's going to get me. I had a hard time using the word he because of the abuse I experienced. So I don't use that. But if, you know, I have that old message of God is a male, God is, you know, going to get me, going to harm me, you know, in the back of my mind, that's what I'm going to see, in a sense. So trust what God reveals to you in your heart. That may evolve over time as well, but it gives you something to start with. Yeah. Does that help?
Great. Thank you. Flora Moon, are you still on? You want to unmute and ask your question?
Yes, thanks, Lisa. Yeah. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Hi, Mary. Thank you very much. I'm coming from Devon, UK in England today, and I've been in CODA for about a year, but I've been in another fellowship for 20 years, and I already see a lot of change for the good since I've been in CODA and with the other fellowships. But I wanted to know, with regards to God's will for me and my own will for me, and I find this difficult sometimes, distinguishing between God's will and my own will. And I'm doing quite a lot of work with vision boards and things like that. And sometimes I don't know, you know, how much my will is coming into place by doing vision boards, by, you know, manifesting certain things and knowing what God's will is for me and my will is for me. And I just wanted to ask you that.
Right. Sure. Thank you. So, that's a big question. So I'll, just from my own perspective, is that part of when I believe I'm in my will, there's usually expectation involved. There's usually fear involved. There's usually, or excitement, fear, excitement. You know, they both come from the same part of the brain. But there's fantasy involved. A lot of times when I'm in my will, it's like things better happen the way I want them to happen. And if they don't, then that means blah, whatever that means on there. And so how I look at for God's will is that I do my footwork, let go of the outcomes, and then watch and see what happens. Mm. You know, that my job is to, you know, show up and do what I'm supposed to do to, you know, lovingly take care of myself, have healthy communication, good boundaries, you know, all of that, and then let go of the rest. You know, I've heard people share sometimes that they, you know, that they've seen God's will when they're doing like working on a project, like say a vision board, you know, when things start falling into place, if that's when they know that God's will is in, you know, is involved, kind of thing. And if there's roadblocks a lot, then maybe that's us trying to force something to happen, you know. So I've heard that in meetings before. But it's interesting when you're talking about vision board. I had, when I was in college, I had a teacher who taught vision boards, which was so funny. And she had us put at the bottom of every vision board, this or something greater, thy will be done. And I just thought that was kind of interesting now looking at in retrospect with 12-step programs, you know. Trusting a higher power's will with that. So that's how I work with that. I hope that's helpful. You know, I think it again is one of those things, you know, that inside job. It's like, you know, being conscious of when I'm playing God and when I'm trusting God and connected to God.
Thanks very much.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Thank you. Sheila from Ireland, can you unmute and ask your question?
Hi, I'm Sheila, codependent. I'm only in step one, so I'm not very far into the 12 steps. And this was a question back on step five. My eldest son, who's married with a child, a year ago, he took whatever was going on in his life, he turned around and blamed me for his childhood and has cut me off and doesn't let me see the grandchild. But we had been getting on well before then, like the couple of years before that, his marriage and everything. We'd been getting on better than we ever had before. And I didn't do anything different. So it was like, you know, so I was confused as in step five about making the list of people that you've wronged. He didn't have an easy childhood, but I did care very much for him. And I'm just wondering, like, is it a sign of my codependency to believe that I gave him an awful life? Is it a sign of my codependency to accept his condemnation of me as a bad mother? Or is this me being arrogant? Is this me making myself into the higher power to imagine that I had, you know, that I'm this all powerful person who gave him such a terrible life, or is this a genuine step five of something I've done wrong and that I have to make amends for? But I can see that his reaction is coming from dysfunction, not stuff he has to deal with. But I just got a great confusion there about, could this actually just be a mirror of my own codependency, that I'm taking it so badly and feeling that I have to make amends. He said that
Sheila, you're muted right now. There you go.
Was I muted the whole time?
Just about the last minute.
Okay, just flipped off. Okay. So, yeah, I was talking about my son who's cut me out of his life and my grandchild's life and is citing, he's saying he's done it because I don't know why, but I'm to assume that it's because I was a bad mother. And I was just wondering, is my accepting this sudden turnaround, is that just me being codependent? Is this a genuine step five, something I've done wrong and I have to make amends for? Or am I being arrogant? Am I making myself into the higher power by imagining that I could have had such an effect? Because it seems to be coming from him. I'm not sure how much you didn't hear of that, but anyway, okay. You have something. Yeah,
so couple things. My guess, you know, I remember in program early on hearing in the doing comes the answers. You're on your first step right now. My guess is by the time you're done with your fourth step, you're going to have more clarity on what is yours and what is his. But what I can tell you just from myself, you know, I made mistakes with my kids. There was just no way I wasn't going to do that. They were 6 and 11 when I got sober. And then a couple years later, I started my codependence recovery and I was still a mess. So, you know, my kids did not have a really healthy mom. I loved them the best that I could. And I'm aware of that, you know, but I made mistakes, definitely, hands down, with them. So there was two things in that. One is I needed to, which I got in my, you know, being able to look at my fourth step, I was able to be accountable for what I did and didn't do with my children. But that's different than shaming myself and tearing myself down. I was a horrible, terrible mom. I was, you know, instead of raging in with that shame, that did no good. That kept me in that shame spiral, which kept me in my codependence. You know, moving out of that into, instead of feeling overly responsible, moving out of that and being into accountability for my own actions and behaviors, knowing I was doing all I knew how to do, you know, and was dysfunctional in that, but coming from a place of humility as opposed to coming from a place of humiliation made all the difference in the world, because then I was able to make changes. I could own those behaviors. I could own that, yes, this is what I did. So when I went, you know, when it was time to make amends, I could be clear on what I was making amends for. So they were sincere, they were heartfelt, you know, they were clear and direct with my children. But taking on that you're the worst mom in the world does you no good. It'll just keep you stuck in your codependence. At least that was my experience with myself of what I learned. So, you know, it's hard, you know, for, you know, people who have children, and this is, you can see where this has gotten passed on, you know, but it's also something that's healable, you know, but it takes to heal a relationship. Both people have to do their part, but we can do ours. We can do ours regardless of what the other person does or not.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Thank you, Mary. Mary, we have a question from the chat regarding the fourth step. Do you have suggestions for this person and others who get bogged down into so much detail and perfectionism about filling in the fourth step, the chart, the columns, that they cannot even get beyond the fourth and feel so overwhelmed they want to abandon it? And then the second part of their question is, do you consider the patterns and characteristics as the first step or the fourth step?
So I'll start out with the last question first. I think it plays a part in both. So the patterns and characteristics help us acknowledge our powerlessness and the unmanageability. And then out of that, you know, out of that, I need to look at how I took all of that and those behaviors, those codependent behaviors, and how I harmed myself and harmed others through those codependent behaviors, which was my fourth step. So it all, of course, it all blends in, you know, one step helps us do the next step, do the next step, do the next step. So there are parts definitely on how, from the patterns and characteristics in looking at that, on how I specifically harmed others and myself out of those patterns that are part of my fourth step. So, yeah, I think they all, we use them in both in a sense. So on to the, you know, being making sure that we do our, write out our four step clearly, doesn't have to be our only time. So I guess that's what I would say just to begin with. I cannot tell you how many four steps I've done. And so do the best you can do with your first run through, and just know that if there's more to be revealed, more will be revealed. And so then move on to it. Instead of getting bogged down in making sure you got to get every little thing in there, let it be good enough and then move to the next step. You know, move through your steps. Need to rework the steps is always revealed to us by the level of pain we're having with the situation. So that's what I would suggest with that. Just know that it's not going to be your one and only time doing that step. And that possibly what you have down already is probably enough.
Wonderful. Good to hear. Thank you, Mary. Yeah. Mohita, are you still there? Can you unmute?
Can you see me?
We hear you.
The camera.
There you go.
Can you see me?
Yes.
All right. Okay. Hi, it's lovely to see you. I've been dying to see you guys. I've been listening. I'm fairly new to the Coda, and I've been hearing all your recording about all these steps and resentment. It's just the early stage of me, and I just like, oh God, I can't wait to see you guys. It's so amazing what you're sharing. But I do find like a lot of toxicity and condemned in my inner childhood. But I find it very shame and fear to admit all this. I'm still early stage of that. But I do realize my mom loved me so much, but I find it a lot of abandonment, and I find it a lot of my memory has been deleted. Is there anything you can go over it? Because I haven't got no clue. I'm start reading all the books, and I haven't got some of the books yet. And I'm reading this Letting Go of Melody Beauty.
Okay.
I still find it very painful. I do have some therapy as well. And I'm also living in a, kind of like my husband with a toxic relationship. He had a drug addiction, but he's in a recovery. Then he goes into 9 months and he relapsed. I'm just going into that cycle, but because of my codependency, I can't just move on.
Okay. One is we're back to seeing your phone.
Right.
Yeah, there you go. Okay. You were asking if we could see your face. Not right now.
Not right now, so, yeah.
That's all right. So with the first part that you were asking about where you don't have memories and connection. Mm-hmm. So definitely I can relate to that. For myself, I had a lot of memory blocks. What I had been told more in a professional environment, but what I've been told is that if something is too painful or too scary to remember, yeah, our brain has the ability to disassociate from that and kind of lock it away back here. What I was also told is that when and if that memory is supposed to come up, to trust in God for that timing, that it'll be when I am strong enough to deal with it. And so what was shared with me early on is to work with what I have. And so, like I said, I went through the steps many times. Because I kept getting more clarity and actually memories started surfacing over time. I had kind of blips of memories, if that makes sense. And so, as I knew more, as I understood myself more, as I got clear on my codependence, I would go through the steps again, in that. So I started out with what I knew. And definitely if I look back at my first run through on my 12 steps, It was, you know, and what it looked like maybe 10 years into it or 20 years into it, it was very different because of how, you know, my level of consciousness had raised, in that I understood myself more, I knew myself more. I wasn't protecting myself as much. And so I was able to have more clarity in working my steps and having more information. So another thing that somebody had me do, I was told a sort of a back doorway of when you have memory blocks, but is to write down all the kind of negative critical self-talk that I did about myself physically, emotionally, sexually, spiritually, intellectually. And to kind of like list it all out. And because those were the messages that I came out of it with. Even if I don't have the memories didn't have the memories in some of those areas of how those messages got created, I had them. And so I learned them somewhere. Those are all toxic shame messages. They were all learned and not one of them was true. And so then the other thing they had me do is to take each one of those messages and write an affirmation for it. And then to focus on the affirmation statements, you know, as a way to change some of that self-talk. But that was one of the ways that I worked with that, as well, in there. And I just, stay with, you know, I just encourage you to, you know, keep coming back. It definitely gets better over time, and the level of strength and self-esteem grows, and connection with God. It just gets so much better. Just stay with it.
Thank you so much. Yeah. Megan S. from Austin, Texas. Did you have a question?
I did. Thank you. I have been in CODA for about a year. And one thing that I found in my recovery is that I'm trying to find balance. So with regard to step 7 and really sort of all the steps, I'm just wondering how you find balance between taking responsibility for yourself and giving up responsibility to God or giving God control of what's God's.
So I'll try to go through this quickly because we're just about out of time for the questions. But part of how I work with that is for myself is I really am aware of my expectations and where my level of expectations are of whether that's expectations of myself of how I'm supposed to act and be, or expectations of you of how you're supposed to act and be, or expectations of a situation. But I really am aware of working with my expectations and keeping those in check. Because the moment I have expectations, I'm in my codependence, I'm playing God, or I'm giving power of God to you. And so my higher power is out of the picture. I'm just pushing my higher power out of the picture. And so as I'm doing that, that helps me stay accountable to myself. And again, I look at my job is to show up, communicate in healthy ways, do the best, healthy actions and behaviors, that I know to be able to do both for myself and in any given situation with any given person, have boundaries, but first and foremost to put God first so I stay out of those expectations. And so that helps me stay in check and be accountable to myself, without in a sense, making other people more responsible for my happiness than what I'm doing. And so I don't know that, I hope that helps. I'm not sure if that answered your question completely.
Yeah, that's very helpful. Thank you so much. I appreciate you guys.
You're welcome. Thank you. And so I'm going to bring Ken in. He's going to do steps 8 and 9. Thank you all.
Okay. Hello, everyone. I was listening to Mary, and because we ate something quickly for lunch, and I was sitting here starting to get sleepy. So I had to wake up. I'm going to talk both about step 8 and 9 because they're very closely related to each other. So I'm going to take a little bit of time to talk about both, but I wanted to read a little excerpt about step 8 to begin with. To this point, we have made great strides in establishing or renewing and healing our relationships with God and ourselves. It's time now to turn our attention and energy on healing our relationship with ourselves and others, both past and present. Step 8 helps us to prepare to be accountable to others in a direct and positive manner for our codependent behaviors. Step 8 consists of two parts. First, we concentrate on making our list, and then we focus on making amends. I found that, you know, as we've evolved program over the years, and when we were first working on developing the initial literature for the program, I had one of those insights, epiphanies that Bill W. and Bill W.'s wisdom, he put the 8th and 9th step in the 8th and 9th slot. Because for me as a codependent, if I saw what I had been doing, I would be running around trying to tell everybody, I'm really sorry, I'm really sorry, I'm really sorry, I'm really sorry. And if you're okay with me, then I'd feel some relief and everything would be okay. But now you've accepted me and told me I'm okay. So I have no motivation to change, you know. So the first 7 steps really pushed me to grow and to change and to evolve and to get some self-parent on board, to get strength on board, to be able to handle doing an 8th and 9th step. I think that, as it states, there's 2 parts to the 8th step, and that's the first is to make a list, and the second is obviously to become willing to make amends to them all. And, you know, I think they're very self-explanatory in that the easier part of this may be to make a list. And the simplest way I've ever found to start that list is to go back to my 4th step and include every single person in my 4th step inventory that I may have been harmed or inappropriate with. And there's my list. And so, and actually that worked very well for me. The harder part for me was to become willing to make amends, and to fight off the fears that would come up for me. If I go directly to somebody and be accountable for my behaviors, what might they do? What if they react? What if they shut me down? What if they ignore me? What if they won't talk to me? What if? All those toxic fear messages, crazy toxic fear messages. And so I had to go back and go, you know, to 6 and 7 and start intervening on those fear thoughts and to write what my higher power's most loving statements in response to those would be, which helped me strengthen the parent part of me. So we talk a lot about that child part of our nature, and that I believe that the steps are designed to teach us to grow up a strong enough parent to be there for us. Because all there is for me is God, myself, and his child. I don't have Mary. I mean, I'm delighted that I get to enjoy time with Mary. I'm delighted that I get to enjoy time with my kids, my grandkids, the people that I love, friends, recovery. But I don't have anyone. I simply have God, myself, and me. And as a codependent, I had to attach to somebody who would somehow give me value and worth and tell me I'm okay and I'm enough and appreciate me all the things that I grew up starving for as a child. And so the steps have really helped me to develop a parent inside. And in recent years, I had the realization that when we talk about the spiritual principles found in the 12 steps, and that the psychological principles found in the 12 steps, from my view of perspective and everything I've read and throughout my recovery and career, those same principles found the same psychological principles in the 12 steps are found in just about every parenting book written. The steps are designed to grow us into this empowered self-parent who will go to any lengths to love and care for God, myself, this child, and others. And that works for me. That helps me stay in a simply focused process. And so that means that when the fears come up about, okay, am I willing to make amends? You know, to me, it's about courage. The willingness and the courage to go to someone and sit down and be accountable for my actions and my behaviors doesn't necessarily mean the absence of fear. It just means that I put it aside, I put it on the shelf, or I put it in my vision, my understanding of God's energy. And like the old Nike commercial used to be, just do it anyway. And it works for me. It works very well. That doesn't mean it's easy. And I will tell you that my CODA recovery in some ways has made my recovery in other 12-step venues. Those recoveries pale in comparison to the work that I've had to put into my codependence recovery, because codependence isn't a substance I can just put down. Codependence is woven in and through all most of my being. I've heard lots of people come to me and talk about fear, and they say, "Guy, this fear stuff is stored up in the cells of my body. How do you get it out? What do you do with it?" And we talked a little bit about that today. So fear for me came up in this naturally. It's not easy to be accountable, but I had to work at being consciously centered in my self-parent, set my boundaries. To coin a term coming from another 12-step program, detach with love, detach from the outcome. And once I could put all that aside, I could simply say, yes, I'm willing. I'm a little scared, but I'm willing. And then grab a hold of the courage and then follow through on it. I want to read just a little bit about step 9 and then follow up on some of this more extensively. To complete our part in healing in our relationships, we must complete step 9. It is the work that we prepared ourselves for in step 8. We will have fallen short in our preparation if we approach step 9 with any motive other than to ask for God's highest good. We make amends only for the healing of our codependence, not to manipulate others in any way. Which means I really had to look at, with some people, what were my motives? What were my motives for making amends? The work for me was to stay focused on my side of the fence, irregardless of what somebody else might have done. So it really means that I had to stay focused on me, basically. with some people that was not easy. It was difficult because they were also abusive, maybe in some way, or mistreating of me. And so I had to be honest with myself. I'll go make amends, but I expect them to make amends too. So now I had an expectation attached to amends making, which means that I had to run a great risk of everything falling through. Like they say around the rooms, expectations or resentments waiting to happen. So I really ran into that quite a bit in my early ninth step. I had to really look at the person. What was I saying this for? Why was I saying this? And be careful to not attach my well-being to the outcome or to how they're going to respond. My well-being, I believe today, comes only from my higher power. If I give my well-being over to Mary and she has a bad day, well, my well-being is shot. And so my happiness, my joy, my well-being, my attitude towards life, my way of viewing this world strictly comes from my higher power. And when I continue to keep it based in love, it works very well. When I keep my attitude and my view towards the ninth step based in love, it works very well. So, you know, am I expecting outcomes? You know, do I have agendas for their part? And I'm wanting them to also come back and make amends for some of the things they may have said or done. Well, they, you know, in another program they call it stinking thinking. And so I have to be very conscientious about that and stay on top of my motives as best as I possibly can. The moment I give my well-being over to somebody else and the outcome over to somebody else, I give them the power of God. And so there's a way that I disguise. The word hope for me can be a true hope for me lies in my higher power. I may have a heart's desire for something to take place. I give it to the care of God as I understand God, and I trust the outcome to God, but my well-being isn't based on it. When I attach my well-being to the word hope, I hope it works out this way. Now I'm into some degree of fear and control and disguised resentment waiting to happen, because if they don't do it and live up to my hope, then I'm going to be resentful, hurt, angry, etc. And so, you know, am I living in true hope? It makes it so much easier for me to be clear and really trust in my higher power, go to you, make an amends if I need to, be accountable for my actions, what was happening for me, what I'm doing to make it right, and trust that however you react, you may or may not react. You may not say anything. You may say thank you. You may get angry. You may get frustrated. And I had to learn how to give you permission to do that. Simply meaning that my well-being isn't based on it. I can handle it if you have some strong feelings about something I've done that hurt you, and I'm willing to listen. But when the moment I attach my well-being to it, now we're in trouble. And I'm right back in very specific, concrete codependence behavior. Some people have asked over the years, well, this person has passed, so how do I make amends? And I'm a strong proponent of letter writing. And I always suggest that sit down and write a letter to that person, open your heart, pull your heart out of that letter. And some people like to do ceremonies with those letters. Some people like to save them as a keepsake. Some people may take them to a gravesite and leave them on the gravesite. Some people go to a gravesite and read them at the gravesite. But I love the process because it's a safe way for us to access our heart. We may be in situations where we're going to make amends, where we want to make amends to someone who could harm us. And that we could run a great risk that they would harm us if we came to them to make amends for our behaviors. So I recommend, again, to write a letter as part of this process when I'm doing a ninth step, to write a letter to that person and be accountable for our part, make amends, write about what we're doing to change those behaviors. Put it aside until the right time comes. Share that with them if possible. If not, you've still done the work to make amends and keep it clean. The last thing, a couple things I want to mention just before we move on to questions, and that's that people talk quite a bit about, I hear in meetings anyway, people share a lot about making living amends, that they're living in living amends to a person who passed away, or making living amends to someone that they may not be able to necessarily make amends directly to. So I really believe that we are making living amends. For me, is about practicing these principles in all my affairs. That I apply this program to my actions and my behaviors. That I live a life of amends and humility and strength and empowerment. And so whether I can make direct amends or not, either way, when I'm making an amends, I am then, in my recovery, then it's my next step to practice these principles in all my affairs as much as possible. Whether I can do that direct or not, but I can stay focused on the amends itself. I can do it through letter writing. I mean, there's so many ways that we can be creative about how we're going to make amends. The way that we clean the wreckage up from our past, though, is through making amends. Not easy to do, but the rewards of these two steps are amazingly healing and truly fulfilling. They have been for me and for many others I've talked to. So I'm not sure where we are right now, but I think I don't have much more that I can add to that at this time anyway. So why don't we open this up for questions?
Okay, we have about 11 minutes for questions, and we've had some people with their hands up for a long time, so they might be asked about previous steps. But okay. Betty, you have a question. If you could unmute and ask it, that would be great.
Oh, okay. Thank you. I actually wanted to ask a question. You just answered one of my questions and what you said. Thank you. I wanted to ask, how and where in our program do we learn about boundaries? I've heard that if your parents didn't have boundaries, they couldn't teach you boundaries. And that was certainly the case in my family. So I was wondering, Mary had mentioned it a little bit in step 6 and 7. But where and how do we start to learn how to do boundaries, which seem to be important from step 1?
It's an interesting component about codependence. Codependence is often related to a lack of boundaries. When I mesh with someone, I lose my boundaries altogether. I don't know where I end and they begin. And then we write the next country and western song. I love country and western music, but some of it's just extremely codependent. You're my all. You complete me. I'm nothing without you. I'll die without you, you know? So I've attached my entire well-being to another human being. So boundaries come from that self-parent part of me that stands up for this child part of me. Just like I was the boundaries for my children as they were growing up, and I had to stand up for them, I'm also the boundaries for this child inside of here. And boundaries come in many forms, but they, you know, most of the time they have to do with fulfilling our needs with another human purpose, another human being, another our desires, basically, for people to. I may set a boundary with Mary by negotiating a desire that she not yell at me, for example. That if we're going to talk, I want to talk in these ways. Is she willing to do that? She may come back and agree to do that. Well, I just set a boundary of what's acceptable to me and not acceptable to me. There isn't, in the CODA literature, there isn't a lot written about it specifically. But there are some in the questions. Yeah, that's what I was going to get to. Yeah, in the commonly asked questions, there's a section on boundaries, and that you may find that helpful. And that's in the code book. Gosh, we could do a day-long workshop on boundaries. So I have a lot, but I want to say, but I think that the boundaries, kind of from my perspective, I've had no boundaries, and I didn't know where I ended, and someone else began. I had walls that weren't boundaries at all. They were intended to keep people out and not let them get very close. And then I had healthy boundaries that allowed me to be close and intimate with another human being, with Mary. But the goal is to never drop my boundaries. My boundaries are my self-protection. So Mary can walk close and give me a hug, and we can hug each other, body to body, but I still keep my boundaries clear between where Mary is and I am. So I'm very conscious of that, especially coming from no boundaries or boundaries that look like rage. So I'm not sure if that was helpful. Did that answer some of your question?
Ready? Yeah, it did. I just have known that that's really important in all the steps, and I was just wondering how, I assume it's something that also builds with step work.
It does. It builds with step work, and it's one of those subjects that I think there's a lot written outside of our fellowship. I would really encourage you to also look at good literature outside of our fellowship that helps describe what boundaries actually look like. Mm-hmm. For example, without getting very far into it, we have both internal boundaries that we set for ourselves and external boundaries that we set with others. And so, internal boundaries have to do with self-parenting, and external boundaries have to do with parenting myself where others are concerned. And so to break that down more, like I said, would take a pretty intense workshop. I know there was a workshop that was done recently on boundaries. And I'm assuming that workshop is available through codaaz.org, but I'm not sure.
Okay, thank you. Thank you very much.
Uh-huh.
Thank you, Ken. We had a question from Julia from Wyoming. She chatted. Question for steps 8 and 9.
Uh-huh.
I've heard some people share that their first or whichever time through the steps, they focused entirely on amends to themselves. I'm interested in this concept. Do you have any recommendations about this or experiences to share on this?
Yes. Because my amends were about cleaning up my wreckage, including with my higher power, I recommend always that on the list that we create of who we need to make amends to, number one is always a higher power. And number two is always to me. How did I mistreat me, abuse me, shame me, judge me, criticize me, condemn me, put myself down? How did I put myself in unsafe situations? What did I say to, for example, that little boy, that teenager within me? How did I treat them? Some people will break it out to simply do an amend of 8th and 9th step on, and a 4th step on our relationship with ourselves. But I tend to do all of it in one that works for me. So there's no set rule for this or guideline, but I just recommend people include HP and yourself first, both in a 4-step inventory and in our amends list.
Great. Thanks, Ken.
So, no, go ahead.
I was going to say Julie B. had her hand up.
Okay. Julie.
Hi, Ken. This is Julie B. from Las Vegas. Thank you for your love and light. Yeah. Hi. I actually had a comment on step 6 and 7. Is
Please.
That okay?
Absolutely.
Okay, thank you. So, thank you. So, Mary, I attended Mary's workshop several years ago on step 6 and 7. And at work, Mary, what you said about listing my character defects and replacing with my higher power's will. So, for example, I was saturated in financial fear before COVID-19. I was my spiritual dilemma. I was addicted to fear, financial fear. So in the beverage program, there is a prayer called On Awakening in AA. So I do this prayer every single day. And what I do is I say, On Awakening, God, please direct my thoughts and actions and keep me free from self-will and replace it with God's will. And then I go down the list every day. And then I got to, please remove my control, replace it with faith. Please remove my shame, replace it with self-acceptance. Please remove my financial fear and replace it with financial faith. Mm-hmm. And so I kept on doing this prayer over and over. Then COVID-19 hit. And then all of a sudden my employer offered this unlimited amount of money. Overtime. So what I'm saying is God's timing is not my timing. And that prayer, attending your workshop, Mary, really helped because, and then you also said, Mary, I need to meditate on love. And that is all my higher power's will. So I just want to thank you for, sharing that with me. And I do it every day and my list is long, you know, so, and I do the affirmations as well. Thank you.
Thank you, Julie.
That was great. Kate from England, did you have a question?
Hi, yeah. Can you hear me?
Oh, hi, Kate.
Hi, Ken. Hi, Mary.
Hi.
Hi. Thank you so much. Thank you, everyone, for giving service, making this possible. I know it's a lot of work. Actually, my question was really about step 6 and 7.
Okay.
Oh, there you are. I mean, I've identified with everything you both shared. It's so affirming, it's so inspiring and, validating. The longer I'm in recovery, the more I realize that step 6, particularly step 6 and step 7, to me, are very much connected with my first three steps, particularly step 3. And when I'm on my knees every morning, and I'm working my step 1, 2, and 3, I'm also handing over my, what I call my big 6 of my character defects. I can't see you. I've got a blank screen, so it's very weird talking to a blank screen. Anyway, so my question actually is, could you tell me what to you is the difference between character defects and shortcomings, please?
Well, yes, I can tell you from my perspective, and this will take a moment or so, but I'm glad that you asked because it's something that I kind of became aware of a few years ago and have been looking at more specifically and more seriously. We have to go back to the beginning, okay? The first 6 steps were written by the Oxford Movement, which was a Christian organization that, tended to lean towards shaming alcoholics into recovery. They were somewhat mildly successful, but better than no success at all. And so Bill was very drawn to that. I don't remember exactly how many years it was before Bill wrote the last 6 steps. So it's like, I don't know what I was doing, but I had this, wow, well, that makes sense because because what I believe, and this I believe with my, and this is my belief, but I believe it in my heart. I believe that that character defects is a shaming statement. Mm-hmm. It implies that we are defective. And I believe that Bill saw that. And I believe that Bill wrote the seventh step in such a way as to say the same thing, but call it what it is, shortcomings. These are ways that I learned to behave that aren't healthy. That doesn't mean I'm defective, I'm wrong, or I'm bad. And so I believe he could see that in his wisdom, and he wrote that his version of the sixth step and the seventh step. And so to me, they are the same. I've heard many theories about the differences between shortcomings and character defects years and years ago. I looked them up in the dictionary, and they basically said the same thing. And so I trust, and you know, and then I prayed about it. And I said, if this is not accurate, make it very clear to me. What I got was, who gave you the idea a few months ago? Is what I heard, because I hear my higher power's voice a lot. So we talk a lot. And it was like, okay, well, thank you for the inspiration, and I'll go with that. And that rings true to my heart, and I leave it with that, and I don't try to explore it anymore. So I focus a lot on the word, when I do focus, like in the work that we've been doing here, I focus on the word shortcomings, because they are my shortcomings. I'm not defective. In my belief system, you, everyone that I see here, Mary, me, all of us, we are truly, at a fundamental level, amazing, beautiful, spiritual creations of a loving higher power. And anything short of that, including the phrase, you know, character defects, is shaming to me. And I'm a very strong proponent of intervening on toxic shame as much as possible, because I see what it does to every human being.
Yeah.
So, yeah, thanks for asking the question. I was a little surprised, because I mentioned to Mary earlier that I'd sure like to bring up that point, and sure enough, you made it available, so thank you.
Thank you, Ken. Lovely to see you.
You as well.
Ken Sia has had her name, her hand up for a long time. I think I'm saying
okay.
CIA, if you'd unmute and ask.
Hi, thank you so much. Can you hear me okay?
Yes.
Oh, thanks so much. I really appreciate this workshop today. It's fantastic. Thank you so much. The question is about, I heard about the fear or shame, and also you included abandonment, Ken, about, you know, being kind of the core, you know, whatever, that being kind of at the heart of it. And I really relate to that. And I really struggle with distinguishing between what is a healthy need for attention and time and validation from other people, and what is, when does it become dependency? I really struggle with that. And if you don't mind, if I hope it doesn't confuse things, I don't have a strong enough connection with my higher power yet, but I heard you talk about it's only your God, your higher power, that tells you you're enough and gives you everything that you wanted and didn't get as a child. And it's that concept, that sort of abandonment trauma that I've got, that is so powerful. And I kind of feel like I don't have the resources to put that right or to fill that unmet need. And I think that's what drives so much of my behaviours, is that unmet childhood needs, and, you know, that need for attention or time or whatever. And it almost feels like a bottomless pit. And I just struggle with knowing what's healthy, how much is healthy to ask for, you know, some validation, some attention and care from others, and how much is, you know, how do I distinguish between what's healthy and what really is my part for me to somehow deal with? Thank you.
Thank you for the question. It's an excellent one. There's four abuses in this world, okay, categorically. There's abuse, which is most people attach to as physical or sexual, et cetera, but there's emotion, there's abuse, abandonment, enmeshment, and neglect. And, you know, for as long as I've worked in this industry, you know, we've called abandonment and neglect the slimy diseases, okay, the slimy abuse, because very often when that's taking place for us, we can be in a beautiful home, live very well, have, you know, clothes, food, you know, we go to school, we have an education, we have medicine, et cetera, et cetera. And it looks like we're not being neglected, but we are when it comes to our emotional or sexual development or spiritual development, et cetera. And so neglect can play out in that way. And abandonment is, interestingly enough, one of the most severe forms of abandonment is when a parent is present but not available. And not only a parent, but an authority caregiver, when they're present but not available. So adult children often describe it as being in the candy store. They can hold the candy, but and everybody else can eat it right there in front of them, but they can't eat any of the candy. It's present, but it's not available to them. And so, you know, yeah, I think that it can be one of the sources that drives an overwhelming need to overly connect with people to try to fill the void, the empty places inside. And so what I think is helpful is to recognize, wait a minute, first of all, is this a need? And if it is a need, I'm in trouble. And this is from my perspective, need implies addiction or compulsive behavior. I need you to do this. What I'm really saying is my well-being is based on you doing this or not doing this. And so, and the reality is, I believe today, is we don't have any needs. We have desires, every one of us. I don't even have a need for air. I would like it if I'm going to live, but I don't need to pay taxes. I might go to jail, but you know, I have very, very, very few actual real needs. And codependence is about need. I need to either avoid you at all costs because you could hurt me, or I need to enmesh with you because you're going to fill the empty places inside of me. So balance to me is what codependence recovery is about. And I believe we all have a child within us, and each one of us as a child deeply wants to be cared about and loved and be treated with affection and attention and even loving confrontation. But I highlight loving, okay? Oops. Yeah, I like that word. Had a need for some affection and attention. It's a water. Perfect timing.
Just hooked up onto that.
Perfect timing.
Perfect timing.
And so we all have desires. We want to be loved, and we want to be touched. We want to be held. We want some affection, attention, and nurturing. It feels good. But when my well-being is based on it, I'm in trouble. Okay, now I need it. The moment it flips over into need, just like an addict needs to do a line of coke or have a drink, etc. When I need you too, I've attached the same compulsive behavior to you, and that's not in my well-being, okay? Am I okay without it? Yes. Do I feel like I'm missing some of that sometimes if I weren't with Mary? Yes. I would probably feel that way. Do I need it? Then I'm in trouble. So I have to watch. My language will tell me the truth. You know, my language will, you know, especially when I start using the word need, it's driven from emotional energy that's craving, that wants or whatever. I need to have this. And the fact is I don't. I don't really need to have that. Do I go give affection and attention and nurturing to me Do I look at the man I see in the mirror and tell him how much I love him and adore him and appreciate him and how amazing he is and what a beautiful creation he is, and that spirit inside of him is just brilliant and beautiful? Yes, and today I believe it. It took a lot of years to believe that one. So I can give those to me, or I can give with people that I trust in my recovery program, I can give them the ability to give those things to me too. You know, I can think of 20 people off the top of my head in program I could go to in a split second and say, I've been really missing being held or getting a hug. If you got a moment, or you know what, I've been beating myself up a little bit. Tell me some lovely things you see about me. And it doesn't take very much for them to come right back and go, oh, Ken, how much time do you have? Usually that they'll joke about that at first, and it's like, but all that, that's all it takes, because I was really having a desire, or I was lonely for some connection in that way. And when people are lonely, it happens in three ways. I'm either lonely for God, I'm lonely for myself, or I'm lonely for you. And as codependents, I gave God and myself over to you. So when people, I say, how you doing? Well, I'm kind of lonely. Well, what are you lonely about? Well, I'm missing a relationship. Well, how are you doing in your relationship with yourself? Well, how are you doing relationship with God? Well, not much. I haven't been. Well, would you like a suggestion? Yeah, well, start having a daily relationship with you and strengthen your relationship with your higher power. Start talking to God all day long. And I promise you might hear your higher power talk back and you're not schizophrenic. So, is that helpful?
Yeah, very.
Abandonment drives it, yes. So our recovery comes in two paths at the same time, cleaning up the wreckage of our past and our childhood and our current time and how we are approaching our recovery today. So abandonment may be driving some of my desires or behaviors today, so I can continue to journal and move my emotional energy about my history and my childhood and keep it separate from what's important for me to fulfill today within me. Well, I just need some hugs, and I'll tell you, the world right now is starving for physical affection. Mm-hmm. Starving for physical affection. So, kind of a long answer to your question.
It was so helpful. Thank you.
Okay, thank
you, Ken.
You're welcome.
Questions in the chat.
Okay.
From Annie and Jennifer in the UK. And the question was, I'm confused about amends to a higher power. How can we harm a higher power?
I don't have the power to harm a higher power. In some ways, I'm making amends to myself for treating my higher power with such contempt and judgment.
Okay. I think it was in step 9, making amends to ourselves and making amends to our higher power.
Uh-huh. Yes. So I am making amends to my higher power, even though I'm making amends for my behavior towards my higher power.
Yeah. Gotcha.
Yes. And so, yeah, was I judgmental? Did I rage at my higher power from time to time? Yeah. Yeah. Like that really did a lot of good. And so, did I, you know, call my higher power a few choice words from time to time? Yes. You know, and thank God my higher power knows exactly every moment that brought me to the point to say those things in my entire life and has absolute compassion for how I got there and would probably let me rant and rave for the next 2 days if I wanted to. But thank God I don't, you know, it didn't take very long before I catch myself. So it's like, you know, I was blaming you one more time, God, and I apologize for that. And then I'll apologize in the mirror to me. Because this parent allowed it to happen and didn't intervene and back it off. And let's journal. Let's write about what we're really feeling, because rage isn't a feeling. Let's write about the fear, shame, pain, and anger that makes up rage. Let's talk with somebody. Let's process this so we can go blame God because we're having a bad day. You know?
True. So. Iman had her hand up.
Okay.
If you could unmute and ask your question.
I think I don't know if I'm unmuted.
You are.
There you are. You are.
Okay. So I'm new to the steps. This is actually my second week.
Congratulations.
Thank you. So for me, I feel like in a way I do some of these steps out of order. I don't know if that matters. And also kind of like, how should I start? And I feel like it's so much information. And I actually I was dating somebody that had drug addiction, and I would go to, I think it's Naranon, and that's when they told me about CODA, and it took me like a year to get here, but
it's okay.
Here.
Good.
Yeah.
Well, I think I work the steps all the time. They're so integrated into my thinking process. I'm working them all the time, and I don't even consciously think about it much anymore unless I need to focus some step work itself on a specific aspect. So doing some of the steps out of order, especially in the beginning, we will relate to various parts of the steps more so than other parts, and so we tend to focus on those. But I think I had said it. You may have not been here earlier. I don't know, but I said it earlier. It's so critically important that we not do this alone. That we have a sponsor that walks us through the step process, and it takes time. It's the steps change us from the inside out. It's not like I go by a step and I'm fixed now, you know. And so. Want to work the steps with somebody who can help us recognize what's going on, not only through the mechanics of doing the steps, but how is the step impacting my heart? Because that's where change comes from. It comes from, this is a journey of the heart. My intellectual mind is just a laptop, you know? So, and it'll rationalize things, it will change things around, make it sound good, not good, whatever, but my heart knows the truth, and so it's, you know, I've always referred to the steps as a journey to the heart. And I, you know, learned to live there more fully than ever in my entire life. Do you have a support system or a sponsor?
No, I don't. I left my information on that little spreadsheet that they just sent out, but
good.
I don't have a sponsor.
Well, yeah. It's time, do you go to, you're doing online meetings or in-person meetings at all?
I've been doing online meetings. Mm-hmm. So my ex is actually at a recovery center right now, and they offered a family program, but it's not CODA, but it is a family program. But I realized that I need something that I'm directly working on myself. Mm-hmm. And I've been praying a lot about it. But I've noticed a lot of things have been coming up. So I definitely feel like now is the time to change my habits.
Yes. So asking someone, at least even to be a temporary sponsor, while you're in the process, will help a lot. And they can be, a sponsor is a guide through the steps, through recovery, through a program. And they're here to share their experience, strength, and hope. They've been down the path farther than we have. They know some of the pitfalls, and they can support us. Plus, you know, my experience, really wise sponsors that I have had open their heart to me. And I recognize I'm not alone in this. Never have been. It all changed. Anyway, the page lit up. So I would really encourage you, even in an online meeting, if you're hearing good quality recovery being shared in that meeting, about the steps, about recovery itself, sponsorship. If you can, you know, even chat, you know, mention on the chat that you're looking for a temporary or at least a temporary sponsor, but ideally a full-time sponsor, then do that. Because you may get a lot of people who respond, or you may get none, depending on the meeting, you know. So, but they're out there. Where did you go?
Who, me? Or everybody else?
Oh, there you are. My whole board just changed here really quickly. So, is that helpful?
Yes, that's helpful.
Yeah.
So you don't recommend really doing step one until I get a sponsor?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes, I don't recommend doing that. Get a sponsor first. Trying to be objective, and especially in a step one, when I'm looking at my powerlessness and unmanageability, and be subjective at the same time, is impossible. You can't do that. So sponsors become our objective self, our objective surrogate parents, basically. They model to us what healthy recovery looks like. So if you have access, depending on the program, to like a family program for your boyfriend, I think that's great, because you get, I'm assuming, it's not costing anything, and you can go get some therapeutic support as well. Some programs get threatened by CODA, though. Don't let them talk to you out of CODA.
No, she definitely does talk about CODA.
Okay.
But it's also like the recovery portion and mainly dealing with an addict in your life, even
yes.
if you're not together. That's bad. Mm-hmm. So that's why I realized I need something for me and myself.
Absolutely. So yeah, I hope you can speak to this group. I know there's only 12 pages of people here. So anybody here willing to temporarily sponsor me, or at least talk with me about it, because I can think of about 5 or 6 people just off the top of my head that I know are in this meeting who would probably be glad to talk with me. And I encourage, just for safety's sake, same-sex sponsor-sponsee relationship. Yeah.
I think we have time for one more quick question before break.
It's okay. How long do we go till? We're taking a break, right?
We're getting ready to take one, although we do have one quick question from Yvette.
Okay. Yvette, we can make it quick. Yeah, I'm fine with that.
Okay, great.
May I be heard?
Yes.
Oh, please.
Okay.
Of course.
Awesome. Thank you so much, Ken. Appreciate you and all that you do for the program. Real quick, on step eight, I was just curious because made a list of all persons we had harmed.
Uh-huh.
And in my recovery, there's been so many hurt feelings with me. It's hard for me to determine who I've harmed. I feel like most of the hurt is with me, and I'm having to recover from my own hurt and from the hurt of other people. And I don't want to keep sounding like a victim in this, but it's really hard for me to determine all persons that I've harmed, because in relationships, I'm the one that's the giver, the people pleaser. I'm the one that comes up short, if that makes sense. Can you give me some words on that, a few words on that?
I don't know
if that's making any sense.
Oh, no, no. I hear exactly what you're saying. And it's not uncommon, especially when we come up on these two steps, to get caught up between the hurt that was done to me by others and the hurt that I may have caused others. Sometimes it's both. And So it's helpful to sort out, first of all, the in our first step and early steps, to sort out my feelings about how angry or hurt or sad or lonely or shame I feel about what was done to me by others. So I want to process all of that first, and then that'll help clear it out so that I'm more centered on, you know, if I'm a caretaker. Well, if I'm a caretaker, and you know, I'm basically operating from a need to take care of somebody, which means I need to attract to me people who have a great desire to be taken care of. And as long as I've taken care of them, I'm robbing them of the ability and the opportunity to care for themselves. I didn't like hearing that the first time I heard it. Instead, I had to learn how to figure out how to be a caregiver rather than a caretaker. The way it was explained to me is a caretaking, I'm taking something from the other person to make me feel better. So, as I'm understanding what you're saying, it sounds like you have you're questioning, you know, the emotions that you feel about being mistreated, as opposed to maybe mistreatments that you've given. Is that accurate?
It's very accurate.
Okay.
Yeah, I feel like my recovery, there's been so many hurt feelings with me, right, and trying to heal from all of the hurt feelings inside of me and feeling victimized in so many ways that it's hard for me to determine who have I harmed. I feel like so much harm has been done to me.
I get it. You're caught between, you got your foot in both worlds. And so what may be helpful, Mary had mentioned it earlier, but it may be helpful to go back to the patterns and characteristics, the code of patterns and characteristics, and review those one at a time in terms of your behavior. Have I done this? Have I done that? Have I done this? Have I done that? And to keep it simple, I would recommend just checkmarking the ones that you relate to. Then come back to the first checkmark and ask yourself, who did I do this with? Does that make sense?
Yeah. It makes a lot of sense.
So that you can focus on you.
Okay.
Yeah. All right. Is there anything else you would like? Okay. Thank you.
Thank you so much.
We're going to take a short break here. I'm not sure if we're over time or what, but I'm kind of lost on what the timing is. So are we doing good?
Our founders, Ken and Mary, take us on a journey through the 12 steps, part 3, in progress.
Okay.